This is the story of the golden calf. Everyone wants to know, how could it be, a mere 40 days after the revelation at Sinai, that the whole Jewish people worshipped an idol? How could that possibly happen? Well, some questions should not be answered. Have you stopped beating your wife? Yes or no? If I say yes, it means I was beating her. If I say no, it probably means I haven't stopped beating her, so I just don't want to answer that question because it's based on a false presupposition. What we're going to do is we're going to go through the story twice. First time through, just to note difficulties, problems, open questions concerning the question of idol worship. I don't want to hear answers because until you see all of the problems, until you have reviewed all of the evidence, it's inappropriate to start floating theories. After you see the whole story with all the difficulties, then we will look at one single, integrated, coordinated way to explain all the difficulties, and then we'll have a better idea of what the story is about. So remember, you're just noting difficulties. If you have some reason that you think the question is no question, that will be interesting. But don't offer answers. Don't speculate about answers. So page 493, chapter 32. The people saw that Moses delayed in ascending the mountain. And the people gathered around Aaron and said to him, "Rise up, make for us gods that will go before us. For this man Moses, who brought us up from the land of Egypt, we do not know what became of him." Okay. They say, make for us gods. That makes it look like it's open and shut. But contrary to common practice, don't shut. Keep your minds open, and let's see what else we can find. What is the problem here? What problem are they facing that's provoking this crisis? Moses didn't come back. What is the solution that's being proposed? Getting new gods. Is the solution related in any obvious way to the problem? Because Moses disappeared? Therefore you change your religion? Get new gods? Was it customary in the ancient world when a king died to change your religion? I don't think so. So what is the connection between the problem and the solution? That's one problem. By the way, they didn't think of Moses as a god, did they? Does anything in the verse that's written on the page give you a clue? The answer's not written on my forehead, it's written on the page. Do they say anything that's relevant to this question? You're missing the key word. Oh. This man, Moses. They say, this man, Moses. But we don't know what happened to him. So they're on record that they're thinking of him as a man. So don't tell me they deified Moses. That's not right. That's one problem. What's the relationship between their crisis and the solution? Secondly, what do they want the gods for?
To go before us.
To go before us. Now you know very well that in ancient times, the gods were pictured as doing lots of important things. Fighting your battles, providing you with food, with health, protecting you from natural pestilences, victory over your enemies. Yes, if you're on a trek, it would be nice to have the gods to guide you where you're going. But it's a little peculiar that that's the only function they mention. Just that. And nothing else. Good, that's two problems. Keep in mind. Let's go on. Aaron said to them, "Remove the rings of gold that are in the ears of your wives, sons, and daughters, and bring them to me." The entire people removed the gold ears that were in their ears and brought them to Aaron. Now there's a lot here I'm skipping that's not relevant to idol worship. If we have time, I'll come back to it. He took it from their hands, bound it up in a cloth, and fashioned it into a molten calf. They said, now I'm going to change the translation a little bit to make it consistent with the above, but it's the same Hebrew. They said, these are your gods, O Israel, which brought you up from the land of Egypt. This sentence really is very peculiar, isn't it? First of all, how could this be what brought them out of Egypt when they just made it? And they left Egypt 3.5 months ago. So, there's something a little odd about that. And secondly, the Hebrew here is just as plural as it is on the top of the page. So strictly it should be translated, these are your gods. But then they only made one statue. So how come they're speaking of the plural? You see, that's what moved your translator to cheat. And they're translated singular, because he knows, as we do, that there's only one statue. So to say these are your gods is going to sound peculiar. Indeed it is, because that's what they said, and it is very peculiar. And then, maybe the most shocking of all, is the introduction. They said, who's speaking? Up until here, we have Aaron and the people. Aaron is one person. And the people is everybody else. Now, who said, these are your gods, O Israel? The speaker sounds like he's not part of Israel. And it's they, so it's not Aaron. So who's talking? Sounds like there's somebody else on the stage here who hasn't been introduced. Okay? We've got 5 problems so far. 2 in the first verse, and 2 in this, and 3 in this. Now comes a bomb. This is the real key to the whole story. Aaron saw, built an altar before him. Aaron called out and set a festival for Hashem tomorrow. Now, when the English uses H-A-S-H-E-M, the Hebrew has the 4-letter proper Hebrew name of God. This name has no cognate in any ancient language. When Moses comes to Pharaoh and prophesies with this name, Pharaoh says, I don't know who you're talking about. He's not in my encyclopedia of world religions. If what's going on here is they are forsaking Moses' God and going back to Egyptian calf worship, how could Aaron say a festival for Hashem tomorrow? Hashem is Moses' God, the God of their ancestors, not the God of the Egyptians. Why didn't they lynch him? This isn't what they asked for. Fine. They arose early the next day, offered up elevation offerings, peace offerings, people sat down to eat and drink, and they got up to run. Hashem spoke to Moses, go, descend, for your people that you brought up out of the land of Egypt has become corrupt. You know what this reminds me of? You're at work. Your wife calls you up and she says, do you know what your son did today? And I say, oh, he's my son, huh? I'll bet it wasn't good. Quite right. If he's messed up, he's my son. If he does well, he's our son. If he messed up, he's my son. Now, how can God say to Moses, your people, not my people, not our people, but your people, God is sort of passing them off on Moses. So it'll be good. We'll have to figure that out. Now 8. 8 requires very careful analysis. In 7, God says they become corrupt. Something terrible has happened. What has happened? 8 tells us what happened. They have strayed quickly from the way that I have commanded them. Comma. They made this other molten calf. Semicolon. I'm changing the punctuation, because it's not accurate to the Hebrew. The verse splits in half after the word calf. So again, they strayed quickly from the way that I commanded them, comma. They made themselves a molten calf, semicolon. They prostrated themselves to it and sacrificed to it, and they said, and again I'm going to make it consistent, these are your gods who Israel brought you up out of the land of Egypt. Okay, now I want you to read 8 as if you were a prosecutor. How many counts are there in the indictment? How many criminal offenses? How many illegal actions? Actions against which you could have a law that says, don't do that.
Three.
I hear 3. Do I hear 4?
Four.
Do I hear 5? 5. Do I hear 6? Okay, you said 5. You say the 5 and they'll tell you what they don't agree with. Let's hear the whole list.
Well done.
I think that's the key. He said the key. They made themselves a molten calf. Can you have a law, don't make statues?
Yeah.
Sure you can. And it's possible for somebody to violate it. Makes a statue. They prostrate themselves. Can you have a law, don't bow down to statues?
Yeah.
Yes, you can. And someone bows down, it's violated. They offer sacrifices to it. Can you have a law, don't offer sacrifices to statues? Sure you can. Yeah. The person offers sacrifice. Can you have a law? Don't identify a statue as your god?
Yes.
Sure you can. And the person does that can be violated. Can you have a law? Don't stray from the path I commanded you?
No.
Because that law doesn't forbid anything. That law doesn't tell you what to do or what not to do. Let me give you an analogy. The policeman brings in the criminal to the judge and says, Your Honor, I caught him committing 3 crimes. The judge says, What do you do? And the policeman says, Well, he stole a car. So the judge writes down auto theft. And he ran a red light. So the judge writes down traffic violation. The policeman says, And the 3rd crime he committed was he broke the law. That's not a 3rd crime. You can't have a law that says don't break the law. Because it doesn't tell you anything. It doesn't tell you to do anything. It doesn't prohibit anything. It's just totally empty. Similarly, you can't have a law which says don't go off the path that I commanded you, because that alone tells me absolutely nothing. Doesn't tell me to do anything or not to do anything. So the question then is this. What is that first clause doing in the sentence? Why is it there? What job is it? 7 already ended. They have become corrupt. That's an introduction to something's gone wrong. After 7, I expect a delineation of the crimes. So the question is, what is the first clause of 8 doing there if it's not the description of a crime? Okay? That's another problem we'll have to wrestle with. Okay, now, Moses pleads with Hashem not to destroy them. God gives him a certain response. That's not relevant to the problem of idol worship. 499. Moses comes down and he sees the calf and he burns it and he grinds it to powder and sprinkles it over the water and makes them drink it. 21, verse 21, Moses says to Aaron, What did this people do to you that you brought a grievous sin upon? Yeah, translation correct. What did his people do to you that you brought the grievous sin upon? Aaron says, Let not my master's anger flare up. Don't get angry. You know that the people is disposed towards evil. They said to me, and here's a quote from verse 1. But your translator is embarrassed now, and he makes it singular, although it's exactly the same Hebrew as you have in verse 1. So the translation should have been, make us gods that will go before us. That's how we translate it in verse 1. It's the exact same Hebrew. Make us gods that will go before us. For this man, Moses, who brought us up to the land of Egypt, we do not know what became of him. Now, let's suppose you're reading that as an invitation to idol worship. So Moses is saying to Aaron, what did they do to you? What did they do to you that you brought such a grievous sin on them? And Aaron responds, don't get angry. Don't get angry. Because, listen, this is what happened. They asked me for idol worship and I gave it to them. So don't get angry. Now, why shouldn't he get angry? I mean, is there anything worse than that? National idol worship? Aaron's response here is very peculiar. What did they do to you that you involved yourself in national idol worship? Answer, well, you know that they have evil dispositions, and they asked me for a national idol, and I gave it to them. Okay. Seems to me that's a very good reason to be angry. Doesn't explain why I shouldn't be angry. And then Moses apparently satisfied with Aaron's response, and he goes on to other things. Next page. Top of the page. Moses stood at the gateway of the camp and said, whoever is for Hashem, join me. And all the Levites gathered around. He said to them, so said Hashem, the God of Israel, every man put a sword on his thigh, pass back and forth from gate to gate in the camp, let every man kill his brother, every man his fellow, every man his near one. The Levites did as Moses said, and about 3,000 men of the people fell that day. About 3,000 men out of 600,000 men, and no women, out of the approximately 600,000 women. So out of 1,200,000 adults, approximately 3,000 men were killed by the Levites. The question leaps onto the stage. What makes them different from everybody else? How come the Levites kill that vanishingly small percentage and leave everybody else alive? What difference is there between the two groups? There's got to be some difference that explains this. Okay, at the bottom of the page, verse 35, Hashem struck the people with a plague. Okay, so other people died. How many died in the plague? Ramban points out that there's a census of the Jewish people before this incident, and another census after this incident, and the difference is only a few thousands. So, it's another few thousand. Let's pick a round figure, 10,000. Let's say 10,000 people died. 10,000 people died, and 1,200,000, including counting the 300, 1,200,000 stayed alive. 80,000, 90,000 stayed alive. So how are these people different from everybody else? Okay, verse 30. On the next day, Moses said to the people, you've committed a grievous sin, and now I shall ascend to Hashem. Perhaps I can win atonement in the face of your sin. Moses returned to Hashem and said, I implore, this people has committed a grievous sin and made themselves. Now, if we'll make the translation consistent, it should be gods of gold. And now, if you will forgive their sin, and he leaves a sentence unfinished, meaning that'll be fine. If not, erase me now from your book that you have written. And God says, don't tell me how to write my book. Okay, now Moses here is like a defense attorney. Comes to the judge and says, your honor, my client is guilty. Guilty as sin. I have no excuse. I have no rationalization. I have no justification. No defense. He's guilty. And I know that according to the rules, you should throw the book at him. But I'm asking you for mercy. Mercy. Don't throw the book at him. Please have mercy on him. It's a plea for mercy. Good. What crime is Moses asking for mercy? For which crime? Well, he says they made themselves gods of gold. But I seem to remember in verse 8, in the indictment, in verse 8 there was a lot more than that, wasn't there? Wasn't there something about bowing themselves to it and offering sacrifices to it and identifying it as what took them out of Egypt? What about all that stuff? Shall we imagine Moses coming before the judge, before God, and saying, I know, your honor, that they're accused of four crimes. Making the statue, bowing to it, offering sacrifices to it, and identifying it as what took them out of Egypt. I know they're guilty of all four crimes. But I'm asking you for mercy. Mercy for crime number one. As far as 2, 3, and 4 are concerned, it's perfectly all right with me. Throw the book at them. But for crime one, please have mercy. Which of the four is the least significant of the crimes? Clearly, manufacturing it. Making an idol is not a nice thing to do, but it doesn't hold a candle to bowing to it, or offering sacrifices to it, or saying that it took you out of Egypt. Why would Moses be asking for mercy for the least significant crime, and leave alone the more significant crimes? If you were my defense attorney, I think I would replace him. Now, listen, gentlemen, these are questions that leap off the page. If you don't have answers to these questions, you don't know what happened. You don't know what the story says. And if you don't know what the story says, then anthropology and sociology and psychology and economics and politics and all the lovely academic disciplines are premature. If you don't know what it says, it's not yet time to ask why it said it. Text first, ology second. That's my motto. So, let's start over. And see if we can't make sense out of what it says. And then we'll have time to think about why it said it. The problem is Moses not returning from the mountain. The solution, of course, has to be getting a replacement for Moses. The question is, what is Moses? What role does Moses play? What function does he serve? Moses is the key, the connector, the conduit for God's power to reach the people. All the plagues took place through Moses. The Red Sea split when he stretched out his hand with the staff, and it closed on the Egyptians when he stretched out his hand on the other side. Through Moses, they had a pillar of fire, the nighttime a pillar of cloud, the daytime and the manna fell. Their connection to God's power is through Moses. With Moses missing, gone, they're afraid that they have no longer access to God's power. What's needed is a new intermediary. Something that will link them to God and preserve the connection with His power. Okay, now you say, well, okay, if Moses is gone and you're looking for another link, why not choose another human being who could substitute for him? How about his brother? Aaron is also a prophet, very great man, Moses' brother. Surely he'd be a good candidate. The trouble is this. What happened to Moses? He's 80 years old. He went up a mountain without any food and drink, and he didn't come down. People die. Aaron is 83. How long is he going to last? If you have a person who is the link with God's power, you're guaranteeing repeated crises of linkage. Wouldn't it be better to have a statue, a golden statue, a permanent artifact that will be the link with God's power? Now let's see. The idea of having a golden statue as the link with God's power, is that a Jewish idea? Is that a possible Jewish idea? Could such a thing be tolerated in any way, shape, or form? Or is that something which is unthinkable, completely inconceivable as part of the Jewish religion? That a golden statue should be the link with God's power. Well, take a look on page 447. A picture is worth 1,000 words. So I guess I can save some of my words. Here's a box. The Aron. And it has a cover. The Kaporos. That cover was made of solid gold. And as you see, it was fashioned into the shape of angels. And this box with the golden angels, sits in our Holy of Holies in the temple. I want you to know that when the Babylonians conquered us and they entered the Holy of Holies and they saw the Aron with the angels on top of it, they had a great laugh. You Jews who tell us that your God has no form, no shape, no representation, and therefore have no pictures and no statues. In your Holy of Holies, you have a statue, a golden statue. You phonies, who do you think is trying to kid? We see it for ourselves. They thought that was a tremendous joke. This statue is the link with God. The Torah itself says it in three different places. God says, when I speak to you, I will speak to you from the spot between the angels. On Yom Kippur, when you present the incense in the Holy of Holies, my Shekhinah, my presence, will rest and manifest itself on the spot between the angels. It says that Moses heard God's voice addressing him from above the angels. So indeed, in normative Judaism, in true Judaism, we have a golden statue, which is the intermediary between the Jewish people and God. So, the idea of the golden calf isn't inconceivable. Okay, you could talk about angels versus a calf, there's all explanation of people according to the Kabbalah, but the idea of using a golden statue as an intermediary is not impossible from the Jewish point of view. Okay, now, when Aaron says in verse 5, a festival for Hashem tomorrow, what is he saying? He's announcing that we will have a festival to inaugurate the new link. Indeed, when the tabernacle was completed with the golden angels, there was a festival celebrating the new link. So Aaron is suggesting here exactly what in the end they got when they made the other golden statue. This helps a bit in 4. They said, this is what brought you out from the land of Egypt. How could they say this is what brought you out from the land of Egypt if they just made it now? They're not talking about it. They're not talking about the statue. They're talking about the God with whom this statue is a link. Now, this conception that the statue is a substitute link for Moses is a conception that almost everyone had. Almost everyone. The vast, vast majority. But there were a few who stepped over the line. There were a few who actually took it as an idol. Does anyone care to offer a hypothesis? The approximate number of that few? About 10,000. I mean, there's 3,000 who were killed by the Levites because they did it in public with witnesses who could identify them as worshipping it as an idol. And then there were those who worshipped it as an idol without public identification. They were killed in the plague. That's why they were killed. They were killed because they indeed did worship it as an idol. Correct. That's what makes them different from everybody else. And that's why when Moses goes up the mountain, he doesn't ask for atonement in face of the sins of idol worship. He himself executed the idol worshippers who were publicly identified immediately. He didn't ask for forgiveness for them or atonement for them. He knew that was beyond the pale. He only asked for the crime of making it, because that's a different crime. And that, he felt, could have some atonement. But now the question will be, what was the crime? What was the crime? If Moses is gone, you do need a substitute. You do have to have a link with God's power. So, and the thing they chose was a possible choice. It was not unreasonable as a substitute. So what was the crime? Now go back to 8. Go back to the first clause in 8. The first clause in 8 is explaining what the crime was. The first clause in 8 says they turned aside quickly from the way which I commanded them. It means they invented it.
The crime was that they invented it, rather than it's being commanded. The crime is a philosophical crime. Judaism is a commanded religion, a revealed religion, not an invented religion. Judaism is not based on religious intuition, religious creativity, religious sensitivity, religious invention, voluntarism. It's not man inventing God. It's God communicating with man. To insert at the very center of Jewish worship a freely created human invention is to falsify the fundamental philosophical message of the Jewish religion. Of course, since it's, pains me to say this, since it's only philosophical crime, there could be atonement for that one. For the idol worship, there's no way back. Those people are executed right away. But for the philosophical crime, Moses says, I'll plead with God, and God says, okay, I'll bear with them, because it's only philosophical. But that's the crime. The crime is the crime of inventing it. You know, it's a little bit like this. Suppose you buy a lot of land, and you build a house. And the house fits the zoning standards perfectly. Only, you didn't have a building permit. So then they will not be happy with you. Because even though the house is a perfectly appropriate sort of house, you have to have permission to build the house. Here too, the fact that they chose an item, which was a possible item to serve the purpose, since the authority to do it didn't come from the right source, God was not happy with it. Now, having said all of this, I still owe you an explanation of the translation. Don't they say in verse 1, up make us God? Yes. That is what they say on the left-hand side of the page. On the English translation side of the page. But now, time has come to question the translation. The Hebrew word here is Elohim. That word connotes power, authority, and awesomeness. Since it does so, in the Jewish tradition, that word almost always refers to God. On occasion, it refers to the imaginary gods of other peoples, because they invest those imagined gods with those qualities of power, authority, and awesomeness. But the word Elohim, has other usages as well. Look on page 311. The burning bush. God is telling Moses to go down and save the Jewish people. And Moses is saying, no, no, 1,000 times no. Finally, Moses says, I can't speak. And God says, in 15, you, Moses, shall speak to him, Pharaoh, and put the words in his mouth. I'm sorry, to him, Aaron. Aaron will come and greet you. You will speak to him, to Aaron, to put the words in his mouth. I shall be with your mouth, with his mouth, and teach you what you're both to do. He, Aaron, shall speak for you to the people, and it will be that he, Aaron, will be your mouth, and you, Moses, will be his Elohim. That's what it says in Hebrew. You, Moses, will be Aaron's Elohim. Now, nowhere did Aaron worship his brother as the creator of the universe. But just ain't so. But it doesn't mean God here. The word Elohim here refers to Moses. But since Moses will embody and express God's power and God's authority, even to his brother Aaron, Aaron will look at him, and the word Elohim will be appropriate to describe his brother, even though he is still only a human being. And if you take a look on page 429,
gives B properties to guard. B claims that it's stolen. And they have a dispute. They approach the court, top of 429. The guardian has to swear that he didn't lay his hand upon his fellow's property. I have a liability, ox, donkey, sheep, or garment. And the Ibavish says, this is it. To the court shall come both their claims. Whoever the court finds guilty shall pay double to his fellow. The word that's translated court here is Elohim three times in this paragraph. So the word Elohim can refer to the court because the court has power, because the court has authority. It dispenses God's justice. It participates in his awesomeness. And in the first book of Samuel, chapter 28, a necromancer raises the soul of Samuel from the dead. And when she sees him, she goes into shock. And she says, Elohim ra'isi olim min ha'aretz. I see Elohim coming up out of the ground. And the verb there is a plural verb, even though all she sees is Samuel. So then the word Elohim is used to refer to Samuel. Not a human being. Because she was struck with terror and awe seeing this vision of him. So she used the word which in her vocabulary expresses that feeling. So I suggest to you that the appropriate translation in our passage where it says Elohim is a substitute link for Moses, which because it has bad character of being the link deserves the title Elohim as much as Moses himself deserved the title Elohim. Chapter 4, verse 16. Indeed, there is a mitzvah in the Torah to have awe for the tabernacle, for the place where the statue is. So having awe for the link is a mitzvah that's actually written into the Torah. Furthermore, the box with the angels on it, that led them through the wilderness. That's how the trek proceeded. It went first. What do they say in verse 1? We want this thing that it should go before us. Correct. That's the function of the link, to go before them. So I suggest to you that all of the puzzles can be solved with one single idea. That what they asked for was a replacement for Moses. A replacement for Moses as a link with God's power. And for the vast, vast majority, that's how they interpreted what they got. That's what it meant to them. Except for a tiny minority who stepped over the line and actually worshipped it as an idol. And they were executed. All the rest were guilty only of the philosophical crime. And for that, Moses' plea got the response from God that he was prepared to allow them to live. Now, what I'm telling you, what I have told you, is in the Ramban, in the Kuzari, and if you read all of the Rashis in the entire chapter, not just one or two at the beginning, it's in the Rashi as well. So this could be understood as the simple, plain, literal meaning of the text, and therefore it is not a matter of national idol worship at all. And therefore, as I said at the outset, the question, how could a mere 40 days after hearing God at Sinai, the whole nation worship an idol? That's a question that should not be answered because it's based on a false presupposition. Questions up to you.
Isn't 10,000 people also something that has to be
answered? Okay, some people are worried about the 10,000. Now, let's see. 10,000 out of 1,200,000 is...
less than 1%.
Yeah, it's less than 1%. I don't know. Let that be the problem. Let that be the problem, how 10,000 could go off. But it's not the problem of national idol worship. Yeah.
You know the people go with them?
Okay. Now, what about verse 4? They said. They said. Who's the they? In the context here on this page, there's no clue. But we do have a clue if we go back far enough.
Take a look on 359. The children of Israel journeyed from Ramses to Sukkot, about 600,000 men on foot, aside from children. Also, a mixed multitude went up with them, and flock and cattle, very much livestock. Now, what is this mixed multitude? Mixed multitude of what? Suppose I tell you that the mixed multitude is animals. Is that right?
No.
How do you know it's not right? Look carefully. Couldn't that just be a description of the mixed multitude? That if it is these animals? Right. Good for you. It says, a mixed multitude over them, and flock, and cattle, very much livestock. So the mixed multitude is not animals. Well, what else is there that can go up with them if it isn't animals? The clear truth is that we weren't the only slaves in Egypt. There were lots of slaves in Egypt. When the Egyptian power was broken temporarily, and we were free to go, the others were free to go too. Some made a break for a lot to go scuba diving, and some said, the Jews are on a roll, let's go with them. These people accompanied us out. Now, in 495, these people had been with the Jewish people for about 3 months. Before that, they come from other nations, other ethnic groups, other religions, other worldviews, other value systems. So, They are fellow travelers. They're coming along because the Jews are doing well, but there isn't 100% identification with them. Now, when Moses disappears, these people panic, and they are thrown back on their old instincts, and they say, listen, Moses is gone. The power he represents is no longer with us. Let's go back to what we know. We know idol worship. That's what we're familiar with. But of course, they can't sell that to the Jewish people. So they sell to the Jewish people the idea of making a substitute for Moses. Whereas they themselves interpret it, understand it, intend it as an idol. So you now have these two groups. The Jewish people as a whole, who intend it as a substitute for Moses. And mixed multitude who intended as an idol. And now you have a better picture of why the 10,000 sort of drip over to the other side. Because there is another side. There's a whole group of people here who have a different picture of mine. The words are conveniently ambiguous. You can read them as the substitute for Moses, as I explained. And as the Jewish people surely understood it. But if you take it in isolation from the point of view of the mixed multitude, you could think of it as an appeal for God. So this is really where the impetus came from. And that's who the they is. Now, I'll say something very briefly about methodology here. You have a text, and you want to understand what it means. Sometimes you can deduce what it means. You can prove it. And I have proved everything up until now. Sometimes you can't deduce it, you can just explain it. To explain it, you have to bring in extra information and show that you can make sense out of it. The difference is this, if you deduce it, it's sealed shut. If you explain it, it leaves open at least a theoretical possibility that there are other explanations. On the other hand, one shouldn't be too dismissive of explanations, since in science, all you ever get are explanations. So here what we have is an explanation. Who is the they? In the context here, there's nobody. I have to go back quite a distance to find some candidate. On the other hand, in the context of the whole story, there is another candidate. So is that a proof that this is the they over here? I don't know. Maybe proof is too strong. Deduction. But it's relevant, and it fits the story, and it's based on a prior passage. So it's a reasonable explanation for who the they is. But anyway, that doesn't alter the fact that it was not an incident of idol worship. Okay, yeah.
Is there a number on the day? Somebody's talking about
it. I don't know of a number on the day, and what's very interesting is that there's no settled opinion as to what happens to them here. The 3,000, the other thousands, have nothing to do with them. We don't hear that they're killed for their part in this. That's not mentioned. The 3,000 that the Levites kill are Jews. And the ones whom are killed in the plague are Jews. So what happens to them? I know some commentators say that they were also killed. Others say no, and they caused trouble later in future rebellions. From the text alone, it's not clear. I don't see how from the text alone you could deduce.
The text says that they're all Jews. The text says that all the ones who were killed were Jews.
Yes. The Levites, it says, kill every man his brother and his friend and his close one. Right? I'm talking to other people. Now, one last thing that's just interesting to know. Verse 2, Aaron said to them, remove the rings that are in the ears of your wives, sons, and daughters and bring them to me. The entire people removed the gold rings that were in their ears and brought them to Aaron. Now the question is, did they do what they were told? Three doesn't sound exactly like two. Worse than that, in biblical style, if God says to do something and the person does it, there's a formula for registering this. It says, and he did so, and they did thus, or and they did as they were commanded. Or you have a paraphrase of the original command. It should have said, the people went to their wives, sons, and daughters and brought their earrings. It doesn't say that. You know biblical style, that's a tip-off that something happened here that wasn't exactly what was instructed to happen. Here the oral tradition preserves what happened. And this is the story. The men went to their wives and said, Sadie, your earrings. And she says, Philip, why do you want my earrings? Well, we have a construction project going and we need gold. Oh, a construction project. What is it exactly that you're constructing? Never mind, it's important business and we're in a hurry. Yeah, well, listen, I'm sure it's very important, Philip, but tell me, who authorized this project? We have a committee, and Moses has been away for a while, and we have to take things, you know, seriously, and Sadie says, Philip, if Moses didn't authorize it, count me out. And indeed, the women did not contribute their earrings. This was a strictly male construction project. And therefore, the women are given a special reward that they did not participate. Now, if you will ask, but doesn't it say the entire people removed? Doesn't the entire people include the women? Well, if you look back at the beginning of 32, verse 1, it says, the people saw that Moses delayed. And the people gathered on Aaron. Now, does that include the women or not?
No.
It certainly does not, because in 2, Aaron says, remove the rings, wives, and bring them to me. Which means that they have to go get them. So even when it says the people, the women might not be there. So what happened was, the people, which is in this case the men, came to Aaron and rebelled and said, we want a replacement for Moses. And Aaron said, get the gold from your wives and children. And they went. And the wives said, no. So they came back and gave all their own gold. But they never got the gold from their wives. And that is to the everlasting credit of the wives.
How about their children?
It sounds like they didn't get it from the children either, because it says they took off, they gave it, and it doesn't say they brought it from the children. Had they got it from the children, they would have said that they got it from the children. It doesn't say that.
It doesn't really matter anyway. The children,
right? Yeah, it doesn't matter either way. It doesn't look like they got it either. Maybe the women protected the children as well. Okay.